So I'm going to be talking about a pilot study we did, a small pilot study to explore differences in reporting differences in work injuries and illnesses between soy and workers' comp. I'd like to acknowledge my colleague on the study, Dana Moore, who's in the audience. And even though I work at the BLS, this doesn't represent the policies of BLS. So I'm like everyone else here. And I have nothing to disclose, so. So brief outline, I'll just tell you briefly about the objectives and the methods of the study, and then I want to talk just a little bit about a business survey response model. When we think about BLS surveys and how people, and particularly how businesses, when they get the survey, the process they follow, we use that model often to look at data quality, so I want to go through the components of it, and I'll be reporting my findings according to this model. And I want to talk about the findings about the establishment and the respondent characteristics and some of the things we found about soy and workers' comp differences, and also the next steps of this study, because this is a small pilot we did in 2008. So we had really two pretty main objectives here. We went to soy respondents, and we wanted to better understand both the OSHA soy and the workers' comp reporting processes. Particularly, we didn't, I knew very little bit about the workers' comp reporting processes, so that was part of our objective. And then we wanted to explore the differences in reporting away, the days away from work injuries and illnesses between the OSHA soy and workers' comp. This was also a pilot study, so we were testing the protocol for future use. And this is qualitative research. We're not attempting to make generalizations about any populations here. We're hoping to identify themes and patterns and also generate hypotheses that we can test in future studies and maybe some studies with larger samples. So as a business gets a BLS survey, the first thing we think about in terms of potential areas of data quality and measurement error issues is the record system. One of the things we went out to these interviews trying to find out more about the records keeping systems, the data items that are in them, the complexity of the record systems, also the respondent themselves and their relationship to the record system. Do they use it regularly? Do they know quite a bit about it? Do they have authority tied to the information system? Then the second component is looking at really the respondent understanding their comprehension of the survey when it gets to their desk. Are there things they understand, don't understand? Another component of the business survey process is looking at the recording or the records lookup. Does our respondent actually do that? We're not sure. Maybe somebody else does, their assistant. There may be timing issues in terms of when the records are available and when the BLS survey comes. Fourth, the judgment. We like to know how the respondent makes decisions about what they, how they interpret the guidelines and how they make judgments on what they put on the survey. And also, we're interested in communications, how they communicate the answer to us. Are there some things in terms of social desirability that they don't really, you know, there are certain things that they may not want to communicate to us. And as we think about this business survey process, when we went out there, we were also thinking not just about soy, we were thinking about OSHA soy and workers' comp, so we were asking questions about all the different components of the system. We went out and used what we call the cognitive interview method. It's really a loosely structured questionnaire, and we have topics of interest. We generally asked open-ended questions and asked about the respondents' experiences, using neutral language to guide them. These were personal visits. We recruited by email and telephone, and they took about 60 minutes when we got out to the establishment. The topics we focused on, we knew something about the company before we went into these studies. We know the background, their number of days away from work, their industry and things like that, but we wanted to know more about the company and the environment. We also wanted to know about the respondent. They're a key part. What's their background? Have they been in the safety for a while? Are they in the human resources? Are they a clerical, that type of thing. Again, we wanted to ask questions about the reporting process and both about the kind of OSHA soy and the workers' comp. Tied to comprehension issues, we wanted to know how they understood the OSHA soy reporting requirements, as well as what types of things they use, what types of directions, guidelines, and forms. And then we actually focused part of the interview on difficulties on certain injuries and illnesses that might be more difficult to report and ask them about questions on those topics. So we did this in the DC area, and one thing I might point out is these were early respondents to SOI, and about 45% of our respondents come in the first months, and that's who we used for this study. So we have pretty much a population of cooperative people. We chose a number of different industries so we could get at a variety of industries and hazards. We chose a number of different size classes to go to, from small to large. And we focused on establishments that had had at least one day away from work injury in the 2007 time period. We wanted somebody who'd, you know, really filled out the survey form and also perhaps had done the workers' comp reporting. So we did focus on those. We ended up with 26 interviews, and again, it was the cooperative respondents. We had a lot of large establishments say yes to us, so the sample is heavily weighted to the large establishments. We had a lot of unionized companies. Multi-establishments were about 35%. And again, this is of the 26 interviews. And we also, most of the respondents had between 1 and 4 days away from work in the 2007 time period, but we did have kind of big outliers. As with the businesses, our respondents, so we have these businesses, they had quite a bit of longevity. The respondents also were very experienced in their jobs. They had about 5 years in their current job. About 3/4 that had safety training, and a lot, they had more than 6 years completing the SOI. So they were very experienced respondents. Most of the SOI respondents do complete the OSHA or are in charge of the OSHA logs. This says about 92%, but even those that didn't were part of the overseeing process. So I guess what we thought here is this is a pilot, we're going out there, and it's really, we have a best case scenario here. We have experienced companies and we have experienced respondents. So if we find problems with this group, it's probably the tip of the iceberg. And if we would go out to less experienced companies and less experienced respondents with the SOI, we find things. So what did we find? First of all, our respondents, these were kind of things I'm going to be reporting were kind of red flags to us that there might be issues. The SOI and OSHA respondents had a limited role in the workers' comp reporting, and we only about 58% completed workers' comp paperwork, and also about, of that group, most of them didn't complete the state first report. The responsibility for that resided with the insurance companies, third-party administrators, or corporate departments. So we have multiple people. We have different people filling out the SOI and OSHA that are often filling out the workers' comp, which when you have more than one person involved, you have potential for a measurement error. Our respondents were really quite experienced and had a lot of training, and they said they used the OSHA guidelines, but when we got out there and got into some details, there were definitely gray areas. Most of these establishments that had temporary help workers did not include them on the log. Just as an example, 19 of the 26 used temporary help workers, but only 10 of them said that they put them on the log. Or 10 said they did not put them on the log. 4 said they did, 4 weren't certain, and 1 said part of the time they did. So this was an issue. Also, another real gray area here were contractors and what to do with those. One of the establishment respondents who had employees working as contractors in the U.S., probably other countries too, but didn't really understand the reporting rules on where people should be reported on the log of the establishment or on the logs where they are, and particularly in the military, may have a totally different system. So The other confusion we had with comprehension issues, it was the days away from work and the restricted duty cases. You're always supposed to choose the most serious, which is always the days away from work cases. But there were a couple of respondents who noted that, you know, if they had cases with very few days away from work and a lot of restricted days, well, those would be ones that they might put down as restricted day cases and not days away from work. So that was a potential issue in terms of reporting rules. And also in terms of workers' comp soy differences, because then they would never show up as days away from work cases. There were legitimate workers' comp claims that respondents noted weren't OSHA recordable, accidents commuting, accidents if we were to do some fall here in a temporary domicile, at a convention or things like that. These could be cases that would show up in workers' comp and not soy, and so that's a difficulty. We really can't identify those cases. So looking at the retrieval kind of issues, the recording and the looking up of cases, the timing issues, as Les noted earlier, these come up a lot of came up in a lot of the interviews. About half of the establishments said that cases could be left off soy due to late reporting. Soy is a snapshot, it's done once a year, it's gonna miss some of these cases, and that turned out to be the case true. And the case types, there were a lot of different case types that respondents noted, the repetitive stress and soft tissues, cases at the end of the year, cases after employee separation, and then cases where there's not an employee isn't initially reporting or may go to a physician first, different scenarios that they indicated were potential late cases. Also coming up in terms of respondent kind of judgment issues and timing are the complex injury and illness cases. And these are cases that would be were contested or denied types of cases. And respondents seem to handle these kind of cases differently. I mean, some people said when things are on the OSHA log, things never come off the OSHA log, but a lot of them did a movement of cases in and out of the logs. And these happened in some of the more complicated cases where you have, again, the recurring industry injuries, multiple employers involved, people don't know where things should go, and cases arising after termination. So those were another kind of potential area where workers' comp and soy and OSHA may show some differences. Also, I didn't really have direct questions on underreporting or communications, but I did have questions on incentive programs and performance plans, and actually several respondents indicated that there was pressure to keep injuries and illnesses low, particularly when there are certain types of incentive plans. And then one respondent, a very experienced respondent, talked about what he had heard at conferences, just that sometimes companies were willing to take workers' comp cases and didn't really want them as an OSHA recordable, so that was done, and sometimes logs were fixed to meet performance goals. So we do have underreporting, just noted here. So just in general, summarizing, what do we think might contribute to some of these differences we're seeing between soy and workers' comp? From this study, the limited role of respondents in the workers' comp reporting, respondent lack of understanding of the OSHA rules, the temp help and contractors, and actually the soy in terms of days away from work in cases of restricted duty and what might be included those. There are some cases that would be on the workers' comp and wouldn't be on the OSHA log just legitimately. And then we have the late reported cases, the complex cases, and underreporting pressures. So we have a lot of things to continue to look at as we go out, and I'm about ready actually to go out into Kentucky again and do some establishments. When we did the ones around DC, I didn't have any idea what they reported on their soy or workers' comp. Here, we'll be able to go out. We have the cases linked, workers' comp and soy, so we know cases where there's very good correspondence between the soy and workers' comp and cases where there's not as good correspondence, and we'll be able to kind of have a comparison group between those. We'll be doing more interviews, probably up to 80 in Kentucky and perhaps some in Louisiana from the BLS side, and Washington has a program to do this and likely be done in California too, so we'll be able to look further at these issues. Thank you.
So we have plenty of time for questions if the speakers want to come up front and can start. Sure.
Estimates of overall injury and illness rates and numbers, kind of the thoughts on that? I know that you can't answer it definitively that there's going to be an overlap between those, but any sense of that?
Temporary labor?
Yeah.
You said temporary labor.
That's
contractors? Yeah. Sorry.
Good.
No, no, I mean, that's the first whack at it. I'm not saying that's the answer. But
it's a really big question and hard to answer.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that getting a handle on more accurate reporting is the first step. And once you have a handle on that, then maybe the other.
You know, I want to just say one thing, and it's relevant a little bit to Nancy's thing. This is from a separate study where we went out and visited 13 work sites and examined folks for musculoskeletal disorders. So we did a symptom survey, did physical exams, we did nerve conduction tests, and a variety of other things. And, you know, we had our case definitions, which were sort of published in the literature. And we found a lot of symptomatic people who met sort of these case definitions for rotator cuff or shoulder tendonitis and epicondylitis. And a tiny portion of them had, you know, filed claims, and a tiny portion of them had reported any of their symptoms to employers. So one of the questions becomes, what triggers reporting and what does not trigger reporting on some of these conditions that are not traumatic, you know, sudden traumatic injuries of something falling on them? And, you know, this is just like an incredible issue to sort of grapple with. Tolerance of pain, you know, what is expected versus not expected. I mean, all of that is just sort of goes into this, and I think it's sort of relevant as well for Tim. If there's a lot of general deterrence out there, the economy or a variety of other things, you're going to potentially influence reporting. I don't know if people may have thoughts on that.
Can I just say another thing that I think we need to be keeping an eye on is the impact of greater access to general health insurance and how that's going to be influencing workers' comp. Mm-hmm. So it's a temporal thing
that we need to track. I'm June May.
First thing, I think the relative standard errors. The survey is stratified by industry and establishment size and state location. And we try to sample as many industries as we possibly can. And you know, from year to year, you are going to have a different number of industries within a certain, or a different number of establishments within a certain industry, and different response rates, and that will affect the standard errors. And with very small numbers, like you were mentioning, 50, that's a very small number in an estimate, in a national estimate. So I think that's just the nature of having an estimate, a nationwide estimate, stratified so many different ways, especially when you start getting into the specificity involved with case and demographic numbers, where you're drilling down to specific types of injuries. You know, specific numbers of days away from work. There's a lot of different ways you can carve up that data, and it starts to get very small. I suppose if you were able to get more funding and we could sample more establishments, it would help with some of that. In terms of a definition of COPD, I just don't know off the top of my head. I'm sorry. We acknowledge that capturing latent illnesses is very difficult on an OSHA record keeping log, and that would affect the soy reporting. We have the occupational injuries and illnesses coding structure, which has existed since 1992. It is based largely off of ICD-9, but it is in some ways meant to simplify the ICD-9 system into four or five categories, which is nature, part, event, and source. And then there's also a secondary source for some files. And that just allows us to carve the data more easily than we would be able to using the ICD-9 codes, which, as you know, is encyclopedic.
Ideally, I think employees should be encouraged to report work-related injuries and illnesses by employers, aside from where the data winds up, whether it's in workers' comp or soy, in terms of the identification of hazard and then the prevention. In my mind, ideally, we just need to be sending the message that employers need to encourage employees to report. The problem is that there's a lot of built-in disincentives for employers to encourage employees to report. They increase their workers' comp premium, they increase their injury illness rate, they then could be inspected by OSHA. I'm curious, I think it would be really interesting to know from the employer survey this interaction between their, from a lot of my treatment of patients, I know that there's this area where employees have work-related problems but never reported what they've just said. And there's a whole variety of reasons why it's not reported to employers, both from the employee side but also from the employer side. I mean, literally people are injured, but they will tell me, well, their supervisor thought that it happened because they were, you know, raking the lawn. They don't believe me. There's not a culture where employees are encouraged to report. So is there a way to get at that issue in your employer survey? Holly, I mean, I guess, did you learn anything when you were out there about safety culture? I mean, my experience with most employers has been that it's rather passive. You know, they comply with BLS record keeping regs and they try their best, but they don't see it beyond that.
Well, it could be interesting. Did you ask them at all how they use their the injury information?
That's been the new questionnaire. Okay. So, and also some questions on what would be priorities in terms of, you know, cost containment, perhaps, or, you know, what are the priorities for them in, you know, different types of getting the injured workers. So we have new questions in the survey next time that we get at that. The first time around, probably, you know, we found out more about, you know, things like, you know, it was very, very open-ended. I was just finding out about if policies and things are available to workers or are on the website and things like that. I think we are going to be useful next time too. How open is the policy? But I guess we're trying to get that culture.
The empty box.
One thing to say is that I think it's interesting, in Washington we have a whole different reporting system. I mean, so in some ways a lot of states trigger a workers' comp claim, the worker goes to the employer, and that's sort of the pathway to creating a claim generally. In Washington it's very different, right? You go to the healthcare provider, and the worker and the healthcare provider fill out the form, and the employer can be notified later on. So on our very few employer interviews in terms of piloting this survey, we've heard a lot, at least from employers, saying, oh, this claim showed up, you know, this guy hasn't worked here for how many ever years, how is this attributable to me? So it becomes sort of, it'll be interesting, the comparison between our sort of system, the states, in terms of how they're feeling, how employers are sort of looking at some of these cases that sort of show up without direct relationship to the workplace.
My name is Steve Mitchell, and I've got a question regarding, has there been any allowance for employers to
Well, we would survey contractors, provided that they weren't just self-employed. So they would show up in the soil, perhaps not under the organization that's contracting it out, but with the actual contractors that get surveyed. So they would show up.
Actually, it makes me think if the BLS is thinking about changing some of the reporting things, having the same kind of rules for individual contractors that they have for temporary employees, namely, if it happens on your site, then you're responsible for reporting that.
That's the OSHA, but...
Well, that should be...
Right,
OSHA,
it's the soil, but that's right.
It's who supervises.
Exactly.
Right.
Which
right. Can I say it backwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But that's... Right.
We can't even figure out it out, so we're
right.
Expect everybody else to figure out it out.
I think the state reporting is anybody on site regardless of supervision in the state. So, I mean, it is possible to create rules for people out there, but it is
harder. I think is that the other employer is usually the one who is the, you know, the insurer, you know, where they're going to, you know, so getting the days away from work there, you don't have to be the coordination between a, you know, temporary health agency and getting and
right.
The company that they're at and contractors too, so that does make it a more complicated reporting issue.
Yeah, if, you know, in 2012 it shows, turns out that employee is under time, what type of steps is BLS sort of envisioning taking correct?
You know, I think that's going to depend on what shows up and what the recommendations are, what we'll have funding to do. I'm not going to know the solutions now until we actually have it.
So there's no, like, I mean, I think at this point, probably pretty safe to say there's maybe some degree of undercounting, and I'm just wondering, like, how willing BLS is to look at their sampling methodology and things like that.
If it comes back that the sampling methodology is the issue, and I'm not convinced that it is a sampling methodology, that's the issue here. But if there is, we'd certainly look at everything. I mean, the Bureau is committed to timely, accurate, relevant data. Any accuracy thing we take very very seriously. That's why our procedures are transparent. That's why we allow folks like Ken Rosenman access to our micro data to slaughter us. We're as committed to making this the best surveillance system out there as everyone else.
Yeah, I work for Cal OSHA, and I've been involved in a couple of the log 300 inspections there. And one thing that we learned there was might be interesting for the employer interviews is to ask who actually makes these decisions as to what goes on the log and what's decided as a workers' comp case. Because in one case where we actually ended up issuing local citations against a huge construction consortium, what they did is they had sort of a low-level person who was in charge of doing all the workers' comp and paperwork and the log 300, but he was not really authorized to make the decision what goes where. That went up the chain, and you had up on a regional level. And the thing that was
You know, I'd be happy to answer that. I mean, again, I'm looking at Washington data, and we've gone through about 2,500 cases where we've identified a suspected amputation. And we've sort of broken them down in how we identify them, either by narrative text, ICD-9 code, procedure codes, and a variety of other things. And generally, other than the narrative text, you know, you get about, when you identify it by an ICD-9 or a CPT, you get about 90% of them are actual amputations. And the narrative text doesn't tend to work very well. It's like 60% or somewhere in there that turn out to be amputations. So, you know, what information is reported through the workers' comp agency and sort of what is used to identify the case as an amputation, I think, is very important. The second thing to say is that, you know, when you start combining things, you get to, if I know that there's an ICD-9 code and a narrative text and a variety of other things, you know, then we're in the ballpark of being for sure it's an amputation. So it's a matter of, on some level, maybe the people who look at the data coming up with sort of these algorithms to say, for sure this is one, and here's a suspected case, and sort of prioritizing them. And I know you guys are, I think you're doing that in Massachusetts, so I mean, it's sort of that type of work. Right.
And it was a punch-fest amputation. And she was seen in one hospital, she was seen in another, it was punch-pressed. Mm-hmm. By the time they got to putting it on the code, they decided it was pallets falling down. And OSHA went out on this, and they were, you know, because the employer, in trying to protect themselves from a full investigation by OSHA on all of their presses, they have quite a few, they decided to falsify what they attributed the injury to kind of limit what OSHA could look at. So here, you know, this is, you know, I'm talking 6 months, I'm getting stories like this, where I know there's misleading information, and how will that end up counted?
Dave, do you want to talk about the progression of an amputation where it starts off as a laceration or crushing?
Right. You know, I want to sort of be very brutal on this, which is that, you know, when we start looking at cases, we find a lot more than what it is. And there's a lot of misclassification. And, you know, when we look across different data sources, something is going to be a cut in one data source, and it's going to be an amputation in another, and it's going to be major trauma in something else. So you're right, Elise. I mean, I don't have a clean answer for you, but, you know, there's a lot of amputations where people lose significant portions of their body, and it's coded as something you can't figure out as an amputation. So, I mean, it's just, it's hard.
So it's 10 o'clock, so I'm going to get that and follow up with that individual.